Sagara.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 3rd of September. We will continue listening to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to another in this series of programs of Dharma Radio. Some time ago, on the BBC website, I read about an anger bar that had opened in the city of Nanjing in China. As a migrant worker, the owner had had to deal with a lot of stressful situations, so he thought a place where people could go to vent their anger would be a good idea. He allows people to rant, smash glasses, and even beat up the staff. Of course, the staff are specially trained and wear protective clothing, so it's not as though they come to work every day with black eyes and swollen noses. The bar is evidently very popular, especially among women in the service industries. Some people off the street thought the bar is a good idea. Others were not so sure. What do you think? I ask the question because, as those of you who have been following these programs will know, we've been talking about how to counteract anger. Perhaps the Nanjing bar sounds like a good idea. You can vent your anger and create a bit of mayhem at the same time. You can even get the staff of the bar to dress up as the person you're angry with before you assault them. Isn't this one way of getting all that anger out of your system without actually harming anybody? Well, that might sound good in theory, but though people may not be harming their enemies per se, they're certainly not doing themselves any favors. The problem from a Buddhist point of view with venting anger like that is that it doesn't actually free us from the anger. Because we allow and express it, we create tendencies in the mind which will bring us both suffering in the future and encourage us to act in that way again. What happens when there isn't an anger bar to vent our spleen at? Because we've become habituated to venting anger, won't we just vent it in another way, causing harm to others and creating a lot of very harmful karma for ourselves? From a Buddhist perspective, it's much better to find more peaceful and less aggressive ways of dealing with anger. And that's what we've been talking about in this series of programs, how to deal with anger so it neither harms us nor anybody else. We're following the advices of the great master Shantideva, as set down in his text, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. The sixth chapter is on patience, which is the antidote to anger. In the last program, we followed Shantideva's thoughts on how to react when someone either threatens our body or disparages us verbally. From Shantideva's point of view, a much better way of dealing with anger than smashing glasses at an anger bar is to develop strong patience. As we said before, expressing anger, even in a sublimated form, is still harmful. But if our patience cannot be breached, we have an impregnable armor that protects both ourselves and others. How do we develop such a patience? Shantideva says, by changing our thinking and realizing not only that we caused the harm against us by our negative actions in the past, but also that the person harming us is giving us a priceless opportunity to practice the virtue of patience. And that patience is a prerequisite for progress on the spiritual path. Shantideva says, there's no innocent party in an argument. We have to accept our share of the blame for it, even though we may not be able to see how we originally caused it to happen. Through our attachment to samsaric existence, we were born in this body we now have, a body that can hardly even bear the slightest pain. You'll know for yourself that if we stub a toe, we dance around and moan as though we are suffering the greatest agony. And why do we suffer so much from such a little bump? Because we are either totally ignorant of the causes of suffering and so create them again and again, or even if we do know that negative karma is the cause, we're not prepared to do what is necessary to stop that negative karma. On one occasion, when I was a proofreader, I helped out in an office that deals with creating and printing business documents. One of the documents, with a number of pages, needed corrections to a few of those pages. Those pages were duly corrected and printed out. Unfortunately, one of the printouts was a wrong page, so the correct page had to be printed out again. The person who did the second printout was not the same as the one who did the initial correction and printout, and they complained that if the original person had printed out the whole document again instead of just the corrected pages, the extra work would not have had to be done. It doesn't matter about the paper. Damn the trees, they should have printed out the whole document, the person said. Of course, one document is not particularly important in the larger scheme of things, but the attitude definitely is. If that attitude is continually applied, then many documents are printed out unnecessarily every day, and over the years, one person can cause a huge amount of unnecessary damage. With that kind of attitude, what is the hope for the person's children, who will not only inherit the future results of the environmental damage, but also the attitude itself, thus continuing the destruction? And in due course, that couldn't-care-less complainer will quite possibly be reborn in the devastation caused by their attitude, and then their suffering would be great. For a small convenience, we so often create a very large unpleasant result through not taking notice of what is before our faces. Leaders of many countries seem to be following just such a path with their steadfast refusal to take decisive steps to cut greenhouse gas emissions and so slow global warming. For a very short-term advantage, they're helping to consign the world to a very nasty future. Our anger is just the same. Even knowing how harmful it is, we think it'll be all right to lose our patience and wind off at someone, but then don't wonder why we go through so much suffering in our lives. As Shanti Davis says, it is the fault of the childish that they're hurt, for although they do not wish to suffer, they're greatly attached to its causes. So why should they be angry with others? And then he goes on to point out another revolutionary way of looking at people who try to harm us. Actually, he says, I'm harming them, and they're benefiting me. Why? Because through the harm they give me, they will suffer immensely in the future. But if I can practice patience and only return tolerance, love, and compassion, I will both create much positive karma and purify lots of negative karma. Through that, I will experience a lot of happiness in the future. Just knowing the person causing us harm will suffer so much in the future has the power to awaken compassion in our hearts. So it's not as difficult to return love for harm as it may sound. So we have this golden opportunity when we are harmed, but will we take it or not? Will our habitual angry patterns be too strong? Or will we take hold of our anger and refuse to let it be a cause for our own and others' misery? And now I've gone on long enough without thinking about motivation. Let's, as usual, take a moment to motivate that this whole program will be the cause for us to give up anger, develop patience to the highest degree, and through that, attain enlightenment to benefit all beings. Thank you. Now let's continue with Shantideva's verses. Even though you might recognize the truth in Shantideva's arguments against getting angry with someone disparaging you, you might think that if people deride you, you won't be able to get the respect and possessions that you want. Therefore, you should stand on your dignity and retaliate when you are disparaged. Now listen to what Shantideva says about that. Because it will hinder my worldly gain. Even if I do not want this, I shall have to leave my worldly gains behind, and my evil alone will remain unmoved. Now, nothing, as we know, is permanent, especially ourselves. Fame and possessions stay with us for such a short time that it seems almost worthless to collect them. Think of any famous person who's passed on. Perhaps Elvis Presley, who during his life was an icon, at least in the Western world. He had everything. Adulation, riches beyond the imagination of most of us, and he only had to click his fingers to get whatever he wanted. Now, where is he now, and how did all that respect and wealth help him at death time? Actually, seeing he died of a drug overdose, it couldn't even help him in life now, could it? All that we can take with us are the imprints of our deeds, both good and bad. And if we cultivate anger whenever we are criticized or scorned, will the mental habits cultivated by our anger ripen into happy or miserable experiences for us, do you think? Shantideva here shows us that it is unreasonable to get angry with what swiftly perishes, because long after we have bid farewell to all our wealth and reputation, we will be experiencing the results of the karma we accumulated getting those things. It's just not worth it. Then he goes on to refer to gaining worldly wealth through long livelihood. Now, what is meant by wrong livelihood? Well, anything we do to earn our livelihood that brings harm to ourselves or others. Selling weapons is an obvious example, or trading in alcohol. And now I can hear the howls of outrage. What is wrong with a drink or two, you may say? Well, we don't have to look too far to see the devastation alcohol causes in our society. So much domestic disharmony, and not to mention the fights and quarrels at parties or pubs and bars. But perhaps worst of all in the long run, alcohol completely fuddles the mind and causes us to act in all sorts of unseemly ways. Do you remember the story of the monk who had a female admirer? She tried everything she could to make him sleep with her, but he always refused. At last, the woman became spiteful and told him that he could choose either to sleep with her, to kill a goat for her, or to drink alcohol with her. If he didn't choose one of the options, she was going to kill herself. The monk, of course, was very troubled by this, and so thought long and hard what he should do. All three actions were contrary to the vows he'd upheld so well up to then. He didn't want the woman to kill herself, so eventually he decided that the least troublesome of the three options was to drink with her. So he did, and got drunk. I guess he wouldn't have had much resistance, so he would easily have become intoxicated. Anyway, while he was drunk, he first killed and ate the goat, and then slept with a woman. The alcohol was the cause for him to completely lose his vows, just through so befuddling his mind that he lost ethical mindfulness. Also, to gain enlightenment, we need a very clear, lucid and penetrating mind. Alcohol certainly doesn't give us that. In fact, the very opposite. So it leads us in the opposite direction to enlightenment. That is why selling alcohol is regarded as a wrong livelihood, even though due to its popularity, one can become very rich selling it. Sir Douglas Myers is worth about $850 million, according to the 212 NBR Rich List. Yet lots of that wealth was obtained through Lion Breweries and the avid sale of alcohol. When he dies, all of that wealth will have to be left behind for others to use, and all he will carry with him will be the karma he accumulated through building his wealth. He's now 73 or so he doesn't have all that much time left, even if he lives to 100 or more. Frogblog, a blogger who claims not to have any hand in Green Party policies, but is part of the Green Party website, had an interesting comparison between Sir Doug Myers and a Southland shearer who was sent to prison for being caught with dope. Just after Sir Doug Myers was made a Knight Companion of the Order of New Zealand in 2010, Frogblog had this to say under the heading, "Lag for a Stoner, a Gong for an Uber Dealer." Last month, Southland shearer Lion Paul Joseph Taumata was sentenced to 6 months in prison for possession of 709 grams of cannabis leaf, 22.4 grams of cannabis oil, more than $10,000 in cash, and a 20-litre container of isopropyl alcohol used for the manufacture of cannabis oil. In sentencing, Judge Phil Moran said the money seized did not prove Taumata was a drug dealer. But even though there was no proof the cannabis was intended for sale, Taumata got 6 months. Taumata's case makes an interesting comparison to that of semi-retired expatriate Arthur Douglas Myers. Douglas Myers was arguably New Zealand's biggest drug dealer. Between 1965 and 1998, Myers amassed a personal fortune, now estimated at around $350 million. Remember, this is in about 2010, selling the drug alcohol. Unlike Taumata, whose drug use was likely causing harm to only himself, Myers' mass marketing of the drug alcohol was a causative factor in countless road deaths, injury accidents, domestic violence incidents, street assaults, and instances of work absenteeism. So what does Myers get? He's made a Knight Companion of the Order of New Zealand in the New Year Honours list for his efforts. I'm no wowser and enjoy a tipple myself, but surely the different approaches to Taumata's and Myers' cases must be food for thought. Isn't it time our drugs policy focused on harm minimization rather than imprisoning someone for possessing one drug for his own use while rewarding someone else for making a fortune selling vast quantities of another drug, which is arguably more harmful, with one of New Zealand's highest honours? That's what Frogblog had to say. And it's food for thought. But he makes a good cause for the harm, both immediate and karmic, that comes from the sale of alcohol. And that is why Shanti Deva says in his next verse, "Thus it is better that I die today than live a long but wicked life. For even if people like me should live a long time, there will always be the suffering of death." And he also implies that it is unreasonable to grasp at what we either want to obtain or what we have obtained because it so easily leads to anger. Why shouldn't we make things so important in our lives? Because at death time, all that we've grasped at becomes like a dream or a memory, nothing more. For example, the things that were so important to you 10 years ago, are they still so important? How important will they be to you as you are dying, even if now they seem like a dream? Long before I was a monk, I used to be an actor. For a time in my youth, acting was extremely important to me. I wanted to base my whole life on acting. As an actor, I had some successes and some failures, but now when I look back at that time, it all seems like another life entirely. Acting has lost its importance completely, and in a way, seems like a childish game. Our wealth and fame at death time, Shanti Deva says, will be the same. It will all seem like someone else's life as we move into another existence. As Sir Doug Myers lies on his deathbed, $850 million will become merely a memory. It will not help him one iota in dying or taking his next rebirth. Just like Elvis had to leave all his wealth and fame behind. But both will still drag the karma they created into their next life, and the next, and so on. Shanti Deva compares one man who has a long life with another whose life is much shorter and finds little difference. He says, "Suppose someone should awaken from a dream in which he experiences 100 years of happiness. And suppose another should awaken from a dream in which he experienced just one moment of happiness. For both of these people who have awoken, that happiness will never return. Similarly, whether my life has been long or short, at the time of death, it will be finished like this. Although I may live happily for a long time, through obtaining a great deal of material wealth, I shall go forth empty-handed and destitute, just like having been robbed by a thief. This life is just like a dream. It may not seem so now while we're in the middle of it, but on our deathbed, that is exactly how it will appear to us as we look back on it. Whether we live 100 years or only 20, that is how it will be for us. And, says Shanti Deva, whatever happiness we created will be gone, and we will all, rich and poor, have to go on without even a shred of cover for our nakedness. While I was still a young man in South Africa, I became friends with a much older man who was the boss of a chemicals company. He made millions. In fact, he later bought the company out. He was keen on the good things of life. He was a wine connoisseur and an excellent cook and smoked cigars. He had a beautiful wife and 3 very good-looking sons. But the last time I saw him was when I visited South Africa some years ago, and he was an old retired man sitting on the veranda of his seaside home, wondering what life had been all about. In worldly terms, he'd been extremely successful, rich, and widely known. But in the end, he realized that none of it counted. Looking back, it was all a dream to him, and he searched for meaning in all that he'd achieved. I haven't heard of him for some years, and he may be dead by now. But I wonder if he ever found the meaning he needed. Somehow I doubt it. If we don't make an effort during life, it will not be easy to find meaning when death jumps off our shoulder and we find it has tied a noose around our neck. But in any case, Shantideva then goes on to consider another excuse that a rich man might make for retaliating against his detractors. By my accumulating wealth, says the rich man, I will be in a much better position to help others and so accumulate positive potential. I will be able to weaken the negativities in my mind, and so if anyone hinders me from gaining wealth, I should retaliate. Surely material wealth will enable me to live, and then shall I be able to consume evil and do good. But if I am angry on account of it, will not my merit be consumed and evil increase? And what use will be the life of one who only commits evil, if for the sake of material gain he causes the merits needed for life to degenerate? Shantideva disagrees with what Pema Chodron calls the rich man's mafia-style logic. He says that if to gather our wealth we're ruthless with others, no matter how much positive potential we accumulate by being generous and so on, it will always be outstripped by far by the results of our negative actions. Thus only suffering will result. Returning to Sir Doug Myers again, he is reputedly quite a philanthropist, and I know of at least one good deed he's done. He's established scholarships to his alma mater, Cambridge University, for deserving but less well-off students. And no doubt he has done many, many other positive deeds. Yet, if we think of the number of lives ruined in one way or another by the alcohol he has sold, we may see that the extent of the damage potentially far outweighs the good. Similarly, we may gather a huge stack of wealth and use some of it to help others, like Sir Doug Myers did. But if in the process we retaliate against everyone that does us harm or criticizes us, the resulting negative karma will be much stronger than the positive karma we've created through our generosity. Remember that very often we create positive karma with some thought of our own reward in mind. Our actions are not at all pure. But when we take revenge verbally or physically, our motivation is pure anger or hatred. We do the action as well as we can, making sure that the object of our dislike gets the full brunt of our retaliation, and afterwards we really rejoice in the pain and discomfort we've caused. And there we have the conditions for a fully ripening karma in the lower realms. You see how easy it is to create a purely negative action, and how difficult to create an action motivated by pure love and compassion. So it's no wonder that Shantideva says the difference is so great. It's as if evil is the only consequence. Of course, it's great if we have wealth and use it to help others and alleviate suffering. That's not arguable. But the point Shantideva is making here is that it is the way that we make that wealth that will determine if through it we experience suffering or happiness in the future. In September, the monk Matthieu Ricard, who has been called the happiest man on earth, conducted a series of interviews with Vadivu Govind, who took on the role of a wealthy business leader, and asked him some questions about business and happiness. Here are some of the questions and Matthieu's replies. First, Vadivu asked, "I have a very stressful and hectic lifestyle. What are some daily practices that you can recommend for me?" Matthieu replied, "Even if you have a very hectic lifestyle, you probably find time to go to a very nice gym in the early morning and exert yourself on a bicycle or treadmill because you're convinced that it's good for your health and that you will get rid of your tummy and look younger. Imagine that for 30 minutes a day you can learn how to deal better with your mind and emotions, and that this will change the quality of the 23 hours and 30 minutes left in your day. You can become familiar with your own mind, and through simple methods of mind training, you can learn how to distinguish between the thoughts and emotions that undermine your well-being and those that will nurture it. You can learn how to cultivate inner joy and inner peace. This mind training will diminish stress and bring more serenity. Above all, it will give you the inner resources to deal with the ups and downs of life. However powerful you may be, your control of the world is very limited, temporary and illusory. Ups and downs in the stock market change your financial situation. You may lose your job, or you think you are the boss, and the next day you're thrown out. If you put all your hopes and fears in a situation, and if you think that if you don't have that, you cannot be happy, it's like hoping to win the lottery. If you look at the inner condition of your mind, no matter what it is, you can keep your serenity, strength of mind, and confidence because it's in your mind. Nobody can take that away from you. Nobody. So if you cultivate that, you can be ready for whatever happens. Like a cat. If you throw a cat in the air, it will fall back on its four legs. You will know that no matter what happens, you will have the inner resources to deal with it. When you're feeling vulnerable or insecure, and the insecurity causes you to withdraw into yourself, you will become self-centered or arrogant. If you know that you have the resources to deal with the world, then you don't have to be insecure. You don't just depend on your image, what people think of you, your rank, your position, and so on. With inner confidence, you are open to others because you're not occupied with me, me, me all the time. Inner strength naturally opens you to kindness and benevolence and prepares you to be ready for constructive activity in the world and not just occupied with ceaselessly promoting self-interest. Then Vadivu said, "As a boss, my main responsibility is to bring profit to my shareholders, not to look at things like compassion or the happiness of my employees. That's their personal matter." And Mathieu replied, "That's a recipe for making your whole company into a hell. Nobody will be happy. Some people will fear you. Some people will hate you." I met someone in Hong Kong some years ago who said, "Well, you know, when I started, I wanted to have $1 million. Now I have 5 after 15 years, and I feel like I've wasted 15 years of my life." Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus also said in the Davos Economic Forum that if the whole purpose of your endeavors and life is to make a profit and is totally devoid of the human dimension, you're drying up your life. This is a recipe for sorrow, selfishness, and misery. And when things go wrong and your business doesn't do well financially, since there's no human dimension, everybody will abandon you. However, if there is in your organization a sense of community, a sense of sharing human values, and if on top of that you have a social component, so that you dedicate some of your effort, resources, and skills to benefit a sector of society that the CEO and everyone participates in, then in rough times your company will do better. It's like traveling somewhere on a bumpy road. If the destination is somewhere people really want to go to, and there's a purpose and meaning to the journey, they don't mind the bumpy road. If it's just to take you around and around for no reason, then Varivu asked, "How can I show compassion to my competitors in business? Because if they do well, it means I can't do well." And I'm going to leave that question for you to think about over the next week. We'll answer it next week because we've run out of time. Thank you for joining me today. I hope it's been beneficial. Please dedicate any positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And tune in again next week when we will continue with Mathieu Ricard and Shanta Deva's text. Goodbye for now. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful. Beneficial. Empowering.